you will need to impress a high spren and form a bond, becoming a full Skybreaker. Today, you will take the first of many tests. Though we will evaluate you, remember that the final measure of your success or failure belongs to the high spren. Do you have any questions?
None of the other hopefuls said anything, so Zeth cleared his throat.
There are 5 ideals, he said. Nin told me of this. You have spoken them all? It's been centuries since anyone mastered the 5th ideal, Key said. One becomes a full Skybreaker by speaking the 3rd ideal, the ideal of dedication. We can know what the ideals are?
Zeth asked. For some reason, he'd thought they would be hidden from him.
Of course, Key said. You will find no games here, Zeth, son Naturo. The 1st ideal is the ideal of radiance. You have spoken it. The 2nd is the ideal of justice, an oath to seek and administer justice. The 3rd ideal, the ideal of dedication, requires you to have first bonded a high spren. Once you have, you swear to dedicate yourself to a greater truth, a code to follow. Upon achieving this, you will be taught division, the 2nd and more dangerous of the surges we practice.
Someday, another Skybreaker noted, you may achieve the 4th ideal, the ideal of crusade. In this you choose a personal quest and complete it to the satisfaction of your high spren. Once successful, you become a master, like ourselves.
Cleanse Shinovar,
Zeth thought. That would be his quest.
What is the 5th ideal?
He asked.
The ideal of law, he said. It is difficult. You must become law, become truth. As I said, it has been centuries since that was achieved. Nin told me we were to follow the law, something external, as men are changeable and unreliable. How can we become the law?
Law must come from somewhere, another of the Skybreaker Masters said. This is not an oath you will swear, so don't fixate upon it. The 3 will do for most Skybreakers. I was of the 3rd ideal for 2 decades before achieving the 4th.
When nobody else asked further questions, experienced Skybreakers began lashing the hopefuls into the air.
What is happening?
Zeth asked.
We will carry you to the place of the test, Key said, as you cannot move with your own stormlight until you swear the 2nd ideal. Do I belong with these youths?
Zeth said.
Nin treated me as something different.
The Herald had taken him on a mission to Tashik, hunting surgebinders from other orders. A heartless act that Nin had explained would prevent the coming of the desolation. Except that it had not. The Everstorm's return had convinced Nin he was wrong. And he'd abandoned Zeth in Tashik. Weeks had passed there until Nin had returned to collect him. The Herald had dropped Zeth here at the fortress, then had vanished into the sky again, this time off to seek guidance.
The Herald, Key said, originally thought that you might skip to the 3rd ideal because of your past. He is no longer here, however, and we cannot judge. You'll have to follow the same path as everyone else.
Zeth nodded. Very well.
No further complaints? Key asked.
It is orderly, Zeth said, and you have explained it well. Why would I complain?
The others seemed to like this response, and Key herself lashed him into the sky. For a moment he felt the freedom of flight, reminding him of his 1st days, holding an honor blade long ago, before he'd become truthless.
No, you were never truthless. Remember that.
Besides, this flight was not truly his. He continued falling upward until another Skybreaker caught him and lashed him downward, counteracting the 1st effect and leaving him hovering. A pair of Skybreakers took him, one under each arm, and the entire group soared through the air. He couldn't imagine they'd done this sort of thing in the past, as they'd remained hidden for so many years. but they didn't seem to care about secrecy any more.
"I like it up here,"
the sword said.
"You can see everything."
"Can you actually see things, Sword Nimi?"
"Not like a man. You see all kinds of things, Zeth. Except, unfortunately, how useful I am."
91. Why He Froze. I should point out that although many personalities and motives are ascribed to them, I'm convinced that the Unmade were still Spren. As such, they were as much manifestations of concepts or divine forces as they were individuals. From Hesse's Mythica, page 7. Kaladin remembered cleaning Krem off the bunker floor while in Amaram's army. That sound of chisel on stone reminded Kal of his mother. He knelt on knee pads and scraped at the Krem, which had seeped in under doors and had been tracked in on the boots of soldiers, creating an uneven patina on the otherwise smooth floor. He wouldn't have thought that soldiers would care that the ground wasn't level. Shouldn't he be sharpening his spear or oiling something? Well, in his experience, soldiers spent little time doing soldier things. They instead spent ages walking places, waiting around, or in his case, getting yelled at for walking around or waiting in the wrong places. He sighed as he worked, using smooth, even strokes, like his mother had taught him. Get underneath the Krem and push. You could lift it up in flat sections an inch or more wide. Much easier than chipping at it from above. A shadow darkened the door, and Kal glanced over his shoulder, then hunkered down farther. Great. Sergeant Tux walked to one of the bunks and settled down, the wood groaning under his weight. Younger than the other sergeants, he had features that were off somehow. Perhaps it was his short stature or his sunken cheeks.
"You do that well," Tux said.
Kal continued to work, saying nothing.
"Don't feel so bad, Kal. It's not unusual for a new recruit to pull back. Storms, it's not so uncommon to freeze in battle, let alone on the practice field."
"If it's so common," Kal muttered, "why am I being punished?"
"What, this? A little cleaning duty? Kid, this isn't punishment. This is to help you fit in."
Kal frowned, leaning back and looking up.
"Sergeant?"
"Trust me. Everyone was waiting for you to get a dressing down. The longer you went without one, the longer you were going to feel like the odd man out."
"I'm scraping floors because I didn't deserve to be punished?"
"That, and for talking back to an officer."
"He wasn't an officer. He was just a light eyes with—"
"Better to stop that kind of behavior now, before you do it to someone who matters." "Oh, don't glower, Kal. You'll understand eventually."
Kal attacked a particularly stubborn knob of Krem near the leg of a bunk.
"I found your brother," Tux noted. Kaladin's breath caught. "He's in the 7th, Tux said.
"I need to go to him. Can I be transferred? We weren't supposed to be split apart."
"Maybe I can get him moved here to train with you."
"He's a messenger. He's not supposed to train with the spear."
"Everyone trains, even the messenger boys," Tux said.
Kal gripped his chisel tightly, fighting down the urge to stand up and go looking for Tien.
Didn't they understand? Tien couldn't hurt Kremlings. He'd catch the things and usher them outside, talking to them like pets. The image of him holding a spear was ludicrous.
Tux took out some fathom bark and started chewing. He leaned back on the bunk and put his feet up on the footboard.
"Make sure you get that spot to your left."
Kaladin sighed, then moved to the indicated place.
"Do you want to talk about it?" Tux asked. "The moment when you froze during practice?"
"Stupid Krem. Why did the Almighty make it?"
"Don't be ashamed," Tux continued. "We practice so you can freeze now, instead of when it will get you killed. You face down a squad, knowing they'll want to kill you, even though they've never met you. and you hesitate, thinking it can't possibly be true. You can't possibly be here preparing to fight, to bleed. Everyone feels that fear.
I wasn't afraid of getting hurt, Cal said softly.
You won't get far if you can't admit to a little fear. Emotion is good. It's what defines us, makes us...
I wasn't afraid of getting hurt. Kaladin took a deep breath. I was afraid of making someone hurt.
Tux twisted the bark in his mouth, then nodded.
I see. Well, that's another problem. Not unusual either, but a different matter indeed.
For a time, the only sound in the large barrack was that of chisel on stone.
How do you do it? Cal finally asked, not looking up. How can you hurt people, Tux? They're just poor dark-eyed slobs like us.
I think about my mates, Tux said. I can't let the lads down. My squad is my family now.
So you kill someone else's family?
Eventually, we'll be killing shellheads. But I know what you mean, Cal. It's hard. You'd be surprised how many men look in the face of an enemy and find that they're simply not capable of hurting another person.
Cal closed his eyes, letting the chisel slip from his fingers.
It's good you aren't so eager, Tux said. Means you're sane. I'll take 10 unskilled men with earnest hearts over one callous idiot who thinks this is all a game.
The world doesn't make sense, Cal thought. His father, a consummate surgeon, told him to avoid getting too wrapped up in his patient's emotions, and here was a career killer telling him to care? Boots scraped on stone as Tux stood up. He walked over and rested one hand on Cal's shoulder.
Don't worry about the war, or even the battle. Focus on your squad mates, Cal. Keep them alive. Be the man they need.
He grinned.
And get the rest of this floor scraped. I think when you come to dinner, you'll find the rest of the squad more friendly. Just a hunch.
That night, Kaladin discovered that Tux was right. The rest of the men did seem more welcoming now that he'd been disciplined. So Cal held his tongue, smiled, and enjoyed the companionship. He never told Tux the truth. When Cal had frozen on the practice field, it hadn't been out of fear. He'd been very sure he could hurt someone. In fact, he realized that he could kill if needed. And that was what had terrified him. Kaladin sat on a chunk of stone that looked like melted obsidian. It grew right out of the ground in Shadesmar, this place that didn't seem real. The distant sun hadn't shifted in the sky since they'd arrived. Nearby, one of the strange fierce wren crawled along the banks of the sea of glass beads. As big as an axe hound, but longer and thinner, it looked vaguely like an eel with stumpy legs. The purple feelers on its head wiggled and shifted, flowing in his direction. When it didn't sense anything in him that it wanted, it continued along the bank. Syl didn't make any noise as she approached, but he caught sight of her shadow coming up from behind. Like other shadows here, it pointed toward the sun. She sat down on the lump of glass next to him, then thumped her head sideways, resting it on his arm, her hands in her lap.
Others still asleep? Kaladin asked.
Yep. Patterns watching over them.
She wrinkled her nose.
Strange.
He's nice, Syl.
That's the strange part.
She swung her legs out in front of her, barefoot as usual. It seemed odder here on this side, where she was human size. A small flock of spren flew above them, with bulbous bodies, long wings, and flowing tails. Instead of a head, each one had a golden ball floating right in front of the body. That seemed familiar.
Glory spren, he thought.
It was like the fierce spren whose antennae manifested in the real world. Only part of the actual spren showed there.
So, Syl said, not going to sleep?
Kaladin shook his head.
Now, I might not be an expert on humans, she said. For example, I still haven't figured out why only a handful of your cultures seem to worship me. But I do think I heard somewhere that you have to sleep. Like, every night.
He didn't respond.
Kaladin...
What about you? He said, looking away along the isthmus of land that marked where the river was in the real world. Don't you sleep?
Have I ever needed sleep?
Isn't this your land, where you come from? I figured you'd, I don't know, be more mortal here.
I'm still a Spran, she said. I'm a little piece of God. Did you miss the part about worshipping me?
When he didn't reply, she poked him in the side.
You were supposed to say something sarcastic there.
Sorry.
We don't sleep. We don't eat. I think we might feed off humans, actually. Your emotions. Or you thinking about us, maybe. It all seems very complicated. In Shadesmar, we can think on our own, but if we go to your realm, we need a human bond. Otherwise, we're practically as mindless as those glory Spren.
But how did you make the transition?
I...
She adopted a distant expression.
You called for me. Or, no. I knew that you would someday call for me. So I transferred to the physical realm, trusting that the honor of men lived, unlike what my father always said.
Her father... The Storm Father. It was so strange to be able to feel her head on his arm. He was accustomed to her having very little substance. Could you transfer again? Kaladin asked. To carry word to Dalinar that something might be wrong with the Oath Gates?
I don't think so. You're here and my bond is to you.
She poked him again.
But this is all a distraction from the real problem.
You're right. I need a weapon, and we'll need to find food somehow.
Kaladin,
are there trees on this side? This obsidian might make a good spearhead. She lifted her head from his arm and looked at him with wide, worried eyes. I'm fine, Syl, he said. I just lost my focus.
You were basically catatonic.
I won't let it happen again.
I'm not complaining.
She wrapped her arms around his right arm like a child clinging to a favored toy, worried, frightened.
Something's wrong inside you, but I don't know what.
I've never locked up in real combat, he thought. Not since that day in training when Tux had to come talk to me. I was just surprised to find Saw there, he said. Not to mention Moash. How do you do it? How can you hurt people, Tux? She closed her eyes and leaned against him without letting go of his arm. Eventually, he heard the others stirring, so he extricated himself from Syl's grasp and went to join them. 92. Water, warm as blood. The most important point I wish to make is that the unmade are still among us. I realize this will be contentious, as much of the lore surrounding them is intertwined with theology. However, it is clear to me that some of their effects are common in the world, and we simply treat them as we would the manifestations of other Spren. From Hesse's Mythica, page 12. The Skybreaker test was to take place in a modest-sized town on the north border of the Pure Lake. Some people lived in the lake, of course, but sane society avoided that. Zeth landed, well, was landed, near the center of the town square along with the other hopefuls. The main bulk of the skybreakers either remained in the air or settled onto the cliffs around the town. Three masters landed near Zeth, as did a handful of younger men and women who could lash themselves. The group being tested today would include hopefuls like Zeth, who needed to find a master and swear the second ideal, and squires, who had achieved that step already, but now needed to attract a Spren and speak the third ideal. It was a varied group. The Skybreakers didn't seem to care for ethnicity or eye color. Zeth was the only Shin among them, but the others included Makabaki, Reshi, Vorins, Ireali, and even one Thalen. A tall, strong man in a Marabethian wrap and an Azish coat hefted himself from his seat on a porch.
"It took you long enough,"
he said in Azish, striding toward them.
"I sent for you hours ago. The convicts have escaped into the lake. Who knows how far they've gotten by now? They will kill again if not stopped. Find and deal with them. You'll know them by the tattoos of their foreheads."
The masters turned to the squires and hopefuls. Some of the more eager among them immediately went running toward the water. Several that could lash took to the sky. Zeth lingered, along with four of the others. He stepped up to Ki in her shoulder cloak of a high judge of Marabethia.
"How did this man know to send for us?" Zeth asked. "We have been expending our influence, following the advent of the new storm," she replied. "The local monarchs have accepted us as a unifying martial force and have given us legal authority. The city's high minister wrote to us via Spanreed pleading for help."
"And these convicts?" a squire asked. "What do we know of them, and our duty here?"
"This group of convicts escaped the prison there along the cliffs. Their report says they are dangerous murderers. Your task is to find the guilty and execute them. We have writs ordering their deaths."
"All of those who escaped are guilty?"
"They are."
At that, several of the other squires left, hurrying to prove themselves. Still, Zeth lingered. Something about the situation bothered him.
"If these men are murderers, why were they not executed before?" "This area is populated by Reshi idealists, Zeth San Nutoro," Ki said. "They have a strange, non-violent attitude, even toward criminals. This town is charged with holding prisoners from all across the region, and Minister Kwati is paid tribute to maintain these facilities. Now that the murderers have escaped, mercy is withdrawn. They are to be executed."
That was enough for the last two squires who took to the sky to begin their search. And Zeth supposed it was enough for him as well.
"These are Skybreakers," he thought. "They wouldn't knowingly send us after innocence."
He could have taken their implied approval at the start. Yet, something bothered him. This was a test, but of what? Was it merely about the speed with which they could dispatch the guilty? He started toward the waters.
"Zeth, son Naturo," Ki called to him.
"Yes?"
"You walk on stone. Why is this? Each Shin I have known calls stone holy and refuses to set foot on it."
"It cannot be holy. If it truly were, Master Ki, it would have burned me away long ago."
He nodded to her, then stepped into the Pure Lake. The water was warmer than he'd remembered. It wasn't deep at all. Reportedly, even in the very center of the lake, the water wouldn't reach higher than a man's thigh, save for the occasional sinkhole.
"You are far behind those others," the sword said. "You're never going to catch anyone at this rate."
"I knew a voice like yours once, Sword Nimi."
"The whispers?"
"No, a single one in my mind when I was young."
Zeth shaded his eyes, looking across the glistening lake.
"I hope things go better this time."
The flying squires would catch anyone in the open, so Zeth would need to search for less obvious criminals. He only needed one.
"One?" the sword said. "You're not being ambitious enough."
"Perhaps. Sword Nimi, do you know why you were given to me?"
"Because you needed help. I'm good at helping."
"But why me?"
Zeth continued trudging through the water.
"Nin said I was never to let you leave my presence."
It seemed like more of a burden than an aid. Yes, the sword was a shard blade, but one he'd been cautioned about drawing. The Pure Lake seemed to extend forever, wide as an ocean. Zeth's steps startled schools of fish which would follow behind him for a bit, occasionally nipping at his boots. Gnarled trees poked from the shallows, gorging themselves on the water while their roots grasped the many holes and furrows in the lake bed. Rock outcrops broke the lake near the coast, but inward, the pure lake grew placid, more empty. Zeth turned parallel to the shore.
"You're not going the same way as the others."
That was true.
"Honestly, Zeth, I have to be frank. You aren't good at slaying evil. We haven't killed anyone while you've held me."
"I wonder, Sword Nimi, did Nin Sun God give you to me so I could practice resisting your encouragements, or because he saw me as equally bloodthirsty? He did call us a good match."
"I'm not bloodthirsty,"
the sword said immediately.
"I just want to be useful."
"And not bored?"
"Well, that too."
The sword made some soft hums, imitating a human deep in thought.
"You say you killed many people before we met, but the whispers, you didn't take pleasure in destroying those who needed to be destroyed?"
"I am not convinced that they needed to be destroyed."
"You killed them?"
"I was sworn to obey."
"By a magic rock."
He had explained his past to the sword several times now. For some reason, it had difficulty understanding or remembering certain things.
"The Oathstone had no magic. I obeyed because of honor, and I sometimes obeyed evil or petty men. Now I seek a higher ideal."
"But what if you picked the wrong thing to follow? Couldn't you end up in the same place again? Can't you just find evil, then destroy it?"
"And what is evil, Sword Nimi?"
"I'm sure you can spot it. You seem smart, if increasingly kind of boring."
Would that he could continue in such monotony. Nearby, a large twisted tree rose from the bank. Several of the leaves along one branch were pulled in, seeking refuge inside the bark. Someone had disturbed them. Zeth didn't give overt indication that he'd noticed, but angled his walk so that he stepped beneath the tree. Part of him hoped the man hiding in the tree had the sense to stay hidden. He did not. The man leaped for Zeth, perhaps tempted by the prospect of obtaining a fine weapon. Zeth sidestepped, but without lashings he felt slow, awkward. He escaped the slashes of the convict's improvised dagger, but was forced back toward the water.
"Finally,"
the sword said.
"All right, here's what you have to do. Fight him and win, Zeth."
The criminal rushed him. Zeth caught the hand with the dagger, twisting to use the man's own momentum to send him stumbling into the lake. Recovering, the man turned toward Zeth, who was trying to read what he could from the man's ragged, sorry appearance. Matted, shaggy hair, reshy skin bearing many lesions. The poor fellow was so filthy, beggars and street urchins would find him distasteful company. The convict passed his knife from one hand to the other, wary. Then he rushed Zeth again. Zeth caught the man by the wrist once more and spun him around, the water splashing. Predictably, the man dropped his knife, which Zeth plucked from the water. He dodged the man's grapple and in a moment had one arm around the convict's neck. Zeth raised the knife and, before he formed conscious thought, pressed the blade against the man's chest, drawing blood. He managed to pull back, preventing himself from killing the convict.
Fool! He needed to question the man.
Had his time as truthless made him such an eager killer? Zeth lowered the knife, but that gave the man an opening to twist and pull them both down into the Pure Lake. Zeth splashed into water warm as blood. The criminal landed on top and forced Zeth under the surface, slamming his hand against the stony bottom and making him drop the knife. The world became a distorted blur.
"This isn't winning," the sword said.
How ironic it would be to survive the murder of kings and shardbearers only to die at the hands of a man with a crude knife. Zeth almost let it happen, but he knew fate was not finished with him yet. He threw off the criminal, who was weak and scrawny. The man tried to grab the knife, which was clearly visible beneath the surface, while Zeth rolled the other direction to gain some distance. Unfortunately, the sword on his back got caught between the stones of the lake bottom, and that caused him to jerk back to the water. Zeth growled and, with a heave, ripped himself free, breaking the sword's harness strap. The weapon sank into the water. Zeth splashed to his feet, turning to face the winded, dirty convict. The man glanced at the submerged silver sword. His eyes glazed, then he grinned wickedly, dropped his knife, and dove for the sword. Curious. Zeth stepped back as the convict came up looking gleeful, holding the weapon. Zeth punched him across the face, his arm leaving a faint afterimage. He grabbed the sheathed sword, ripping it from the weaker man's hands. Though the weapon often seemed too heavy for its size, it now felt light in his fingers. He stepped to the side and swung it, sheath and all, at his enemy. The weapon struck the convict's back with a sickening crunch. The poor man splashed down into the lake and fell still.
"I suppose that will do," the sword said. "Really, you should have just used me in the first place."
Zeth shook himself. Had he killed the fellow after all? Zeth knelt and pulled him up by his matted hair. The convict gasped, but his body didn't move. Not dead, but paralyzed.
"Did someone work with you in your escape?" Zeth asked. "One of the local nobility, perhaps?"
"What?"
the man sputtered.
"Oh, Van Macaque, what have you done to me? I can't feel my arms, my legs."
"Did anyone from the outside help you?"
"No. Why would you ask?"
the man sputtered.
"Wait, yes. Who do you want me to name? I'll do whatever you say, please."
Seth considered. Not working with the guards then, or the minister of the town.
"How did you get out?"
"Oh, no, Rolik,"
the man said, crying.
"We shouldn't have killed the guard. I just wanted to see the sun again."
Zeth dropped the man back into the water. He stepped onto the shore and sat down on a rock, breathing deeply. Not long ago, he had danced with a windrunner at the front of a storm. Today, he fought in shallow water against a half-starved man. Oh, how he missed the sky.
"That was cruel," the sword said, "leaving him to drown."
"Better than feeding him to a great shell," Zeth said. "That happens to criminals in this kingdom."
"Both are cruel," the sword said.
"You know of cruelty, Sword Nimi?"
"Vivenna used to tell me that cruelty is only for men, as is mercy. Only we can choose one or the other, and beasts cannot."
"You count yourself as a man?"
"No. But sometimes she talked like she did. And after Shashara made me, she argued with Vasha, saying I could be a poet or a scholar. Like a man, right?"
"Shashara?" That sounded like Shalash, the eastern name for the herald Shush Daughter God. So perhaps this sword's origin was with the heralds. Zeth rose and walked up the coast, back toward the town.
"Aren't you going to search for other criminals?"
"I needed only one, Sword Nimi, to test what has been told to me, and to learn a few important facts."
"Like how smelly convicts are?"
"That is indeed part of the secret."
He passed the small town where the master skybreakers waited, then hiked up the hillside to the prison. The dark block of a structure overlooked the pier lake, but the beautiful vantage was wasted. The place had barely any windows. Inside, the smell was so foul he had to breathe through his mouth. The body of a single guard had been left in a pool of blood between cells. Zeth almost tripped over it. There was no light in the place, save for a few sphere lamps in the guard post.
"I see," he thought, kneeling beside the fallen man. "Yes, this test was indeed a curious one."
Outside, he noted some of the squires returning to the town with corpses in tow, though none of the other hopefuls seemed to have found anyone. Zeth picked his way carefully down the rocky slope to the town, careful not to drag the sword. Whatever Nin's reasons for entrusting him with the weapon, it was a holy object. At the town, he approached the beefy nobleman who was trying to make small talk with Master Key, failing spectacularly. Nearby, other members of the town were debating the ethics of simply executing murderers or holding them and risking this. Zeth inspected the dead convicts and found them as dirty as the one he had fought, though two weren't nearly as emaciated. There was a prison economy, Zeth thought. Food went to those in power while others were starved.
You,
Zeth said to the nobleman.
I found only one body above. Did you really have a single guard posted to watch all these prisoners?
The nobleman sneered at him.
A Shin Stonewalker? Who are you to question me? Go back to your stupid grass and dead trees, little man.
The prisoners were free to create their own hierarchy, Zeth continued, and nobody watched to see they didn't make weapons, as I faced one with a knife. These men were mistreated, locked in darkness, not given enough food.
They were criminals, murderers.
And what happened to the money you were sent to administrate this facility? It certainly didn't go toward proper security.
I don't have to listen to this.
Zeth turned from him to Key.
Do you have a writ of execution for this man?
It is the first we obtained.
What?
The nobleman said. Fierce-bren boiled up around him. Zeth undid the clasp on the sword and drew it. A rushing sound, like a thousand screams. A wave of power like the beating of a terrible, stunning wind. Colors changed around him. They deepened, growing darker and more vibrant. The city nobleman's cloak became a stunning array of deep oranges and blood reds. The hair on Zeth's arms stood on end, and his skin spiked with a sudden, incredible pain.
Destroy!
Liquid darkness flowed from the blade, then melted to smoke as it fell. Zeth screamed at the pain in his arm even as he slammed the weapon through the chest of the blubbering nobleman. Flesh and blood puffed instantly into black smoke. Ordinary shard blades burned only the eyes, but this sword somehow consumed the entire body. It seemed to sear away even the man's soul.
Evil.
Veins of black liquid crept up Zeth's hand and arm. He gaped at them, then gasped and rammed the sword back into its silvery sheath. He fell to his knees, dropping the sword and raising his hand, fingers bent and tendons taut. Slowly the blackness evaporated from his flesh, the awful pain easing. The skin of his hand, which had already been pale, had been bleached to gray-white. The sword's voice sank to a deep muttering in his mind, its words slurring. It struck him as sounding like the voice of a beast falling into a stupor, after having gorged itself. Zeth breathed deeply. Fumbling at his pouch, he saw that several spheres inside were completely drained.
I will need far more stormlight if I'm ever to try that again.
The surrounding townspeople, squires, and even master skybreakers regarded him with uniform horror. Zeth picked up the sword and struggled to his feet before fastening the sword's clasp. Holding the sheathed weapon in both hands, he bowed to Key.
I have dealt, he said, with the worst of the criminals.
You have done well,
she said slowly, glancing at where the nobleman had stood. There wasn't even a stain on the stones.
We will wait and make certain the other criminals have been killed or captured.
Wise, Zeth said. Could I beg something to drink? I suddenly find myself very thirsty.
By the time all the escapees had been accounted for, the sword was stirring again. It had never fallen asleep, if a sword could do such a thing. Rather, it had mumbled in his mind until it slowly became lucid.
Hey,
the sword said, as Zeth sat on a low wall alongside the city.
Hey, did you draw me?
I did, Sword Nimi.
Great job! Did we destroy lots of evil?
A great and corrupt evil.
Wow! I'm impressed,
You know, Vivenna never drew me even once. She carried me for a long time, too. Maybe a couple of days, even.
And how long have I been carrying you?
At least an hour, the sword said, satisfied. 1 or 2 or 10,000, something like that.
Key approached, and he returned her water canteen.
Thank you, Master Key. I have decided to take you as my squire, Zeth son Naturo, she said. In all honesty, there was an argument among us over who would have the privilege.
He bowed his head.
I may swear the second ideal.
You may.
Justice will serve you until you attract a spren and swear to a more specific code. During my prayers last night, Winnow proclaimed the high spren are watching you. I won't be surprised if it takes mere months before you achieve the third ideal.
Months? No. He would not take months. But he did not swear quite yet. Instead, he nodded toward the prison.
Pardon, Master. A question. You knew this breakout would happen, didn't you?
We suspected. One of our teams investigated this man and discovered how he was using his funds. When the call came, we were not surprised. It provided a perfect testing opportunity.
Why not deal with him earlier?
You must understand our purpose and our place, a fine point difficult for many squires to grasp. That man had not yet broken a law. His duty was to imprison the convicts, which he had done. He was allowed to judge if his methods were satisfactory or not. Only once he failed, and his charges had escaped, could we mete out justice.
Zeth nodded.
I swear to seek justice, to let it guide me, until I find a more perfect ideal.
These words are accepted, Key said.
She removed a glowing emerald sphere from her pouch.
Take your place above, squire.
Zeth regarded the sphere, then, trembling, breathed in the stormlight. It returned to him in a rush. The skies were his once again. 93. Kata. Taxil mentioned Yelignar, named Blightwind, in an oft-cited quote. Though Yasna Kolin has famously called its accuracy into question, I believe it. From Hesse's Mythica, page 26. When Adolin woke up, he was still in the nightmare. The dark sky, glass ground, the strange creatures. He had a crick in his neck and a pain in his back. He'd never mastered the sleep-anywhere skill the grunts bragged about. Father could have slept on the ground, a part of him thought. Dalinar is a true soldier. Adolin thought again of the jolt he'd felt when ramming his dagger through Sadius's eye and into his brain. Satisfaction and shame. Strip away Adolin's nobility and what was left. A duelist, when a world needed generals. A hothead who couldn't even take an insult? A murderer? He threw off his coat and sat up, then jumped and gasped as he found the woman with the scratched-out eyes looming over him.
Ishar's soul! Adolin cursed. Do you have to stay so close?
She didn't move. Adolin sighed, then changed the dressing on his shallow shoulder cut, using bandages from his pocket. Nearby, Shallan and Azure catalogued their meager supplies. Kaladin trudged over to join them. Had the bridge boy slept? Adolin stretched, then, accompanied by his ghostly spren, walked down the short slope to the ocean of glass beads. A few life spren floated nearby. On this side, their glowing green motes had tufts of white hair that rippled as they danced and bobbed. Perhaps they were circling plants by the riverbank in the physical realm? Those small dots of light swimming above the rock might be the souls of fish,
How did that work? In the real world, they'd be in the water. So shouldn't they be inside the stone? He knew so little and felt so overwhelmed. So insignificant. A fierce spren crawled up out of the ocean of beads, purple antenna pointing at him. It scuttled closer until Adolin picked up some beads and threw one at the spren, which scuttled back into the ocean and lurked there, watching him. "What do you think of all this?" Adolin asked the woman with the scratched-out eyes. She didn't respond, but he often talked to his sword without it responding. He tossed up one of the beads and caught it. Shallan could tell what each represented, but all he got was a dull impression of something red. "I'm being childish, aren't I?" Adolin asked. "So, forces moving in the world now make me look insignificant. That's no different from a child growing up and realizing his little life isn't the center of the universe, right?" Problem was, his little life had been the center of the universe growing up. "Welcome to being the son of Dalinar Storming Blackthorn." He hurled the spear into the sea where it skittered against its fellows. Adolin sighed, then started a mourning kata. Without a sword, he fell back on the first kata he'd ever learned, an extended sequence of stretches, hand-to-hand moves, and stances to help loosen his muscles. The forms calmed him. The world was turning on its head, but familiar things were still familiar. Strange that he should have come to that revelation. About halfway through, he noticed Azure standing on the bank. She walked down the slope and fell into line beside him, doing the same kata. She must have known it already, for she kept pace with him exactly. They stepped back and forth along the rocks, sparring with their own shadows, until Kaladin approached and joined them. He wasn't as practiced and cursed under his breath as he got a sequence wrong, but he'd obviously done it before, too. "He must have learned it from Zahel," Adolin realized. The three moved together, their breathing controlled, scraping boots on the glass. The sea of beads rolling against itself began to sound soothing, even rhythmic. "The world is the same as it's always been," Adolin thought. "Those things we're finding, monsters and radiance, aren't new. They were only hidden. The world has always been like this, even if I didn't know it." And Adolin... he was still himself. He had all the same things to be proud of, didn't he? Same strengths, same accomplishments, same flaws, too. "Are you three dancing?" a voice suddenly piped up. Adolin immediately spun around. Shallan had settled on the slope above them, still wearing her white uniform, hat, and single glove. He found himself grinning stupidly. "It's a warm-up kata," he explained. "You—"
"I know what it is. You tried to teach it to me, remember? I just thought it odd to see you all down here like that."
She shook her head.
"Weren't we going to plan how to get out of here?"
Together, they started up the slope, and Azure fell into step beside Adolin.
"Where did you learn that kata?"
"From my sword master." "You?"
"Likewise." As they approached their camp in the small nest-like depression in the obsidian ground, something felt off to Adolin. Where was his sword? The woman with the scratched-out eyes? He stepped back and spotted her standing on the coast, looking at her feet.
"All right," Shallan said, drawing him back. "I made a list of our supplies."
She gestured with a pencil toward the items, which were arrayed on the ground as she spoke.
"One bag of gemstones from the Emerald Reserve. I used roughly half of our stormlight in our transfer to Shadesmar and crossing the Sea of Beads. We have my satchel with charcoal, reed pens, brushes, ink, lacquer, some solvents, three sketch pads, my sharpening knife, and one jar of jam I had stowed inside for an emergency snack."
"Wonderful," Kaladin said. "I'm sure a pile of brushes will be useful in fighting off void spren."
"Better than your tongue, which is notably dull lately. Adolin has his side knife, but our only real weapon is Azure's shard blade. Kaladin brought the bag of gemstones inside his pack, which fortunately also contained his travel rations. 3 meals of flatbread and jerked pork. We also have a water jug and 3 canteens.
Mine is half empty, Adolin noted.
Mine too,
Azure said.
Which means we have maybe 1 day's worth of water and 3 meals for 4 people. Last time I crossed Shades Mar, it took 4 weeks.
Obviously, Kaladin said, we have to get back through the Oath Gate into the city.
Pattern hummed, standing behind Shallan. He seemed like a statue. He didn't shift his weight or move in small ways like a human would. Kaladin's spren was different. She always seemed to be moving, slipping this way or that, girlish dress rippling as she walked, her hair swaying.
Bad, Pattern said. The spren of the Oath Gate are bad now.
Do we have any other options? Kaladin said.
I remember some, Syl said. Much more than I used to. Our land, every land, is 3 realms. The highest is the spiritual, where gods live. There, all things, times, and spaces are made into one. We're now in the cognitive realm, Shadesmar, where spren live. You are from the physical realm. The only way I know of to transfer there is to be pulled by human emotions. That won't help you, as you're not spren.
There's another way to transfer between realms, Azure said. I've used it.
Her hair had recovered its dark coloring, and it seemed to Adolin that her scars had faded. Something about her was downright strange. She seemed almost like a spren herself. She bore his scrutiny, looking from him to Kaladin to Shallan. Finally, she sighed deeply.
Story time?
Yes, please, Adolin replied. You've traveled in this place before?
I'm from a far land, and I came to Roshar by crossing this place, Shadesmar.
All right, Adolin said, but why?
I came chasing someone.
A friend?
A criminal, she said softly.
You're a soldier, though, Kaladin said.
Not really. In Kolinar, I merely stepped up to do a job nobody else was doing. I thought perhaps the wall guard would have information on the man I'm hunting. Everything went wrong, and I got stuck.
When you arrived in our land, Shallan said, you used an oath gate to get from Shadesmar to the physical realm?
No,
Azure laughed, shaking her head.
I didn't know of those until Cal told me about them. I used a portal between realms. Cultivation's perpendicularity, they call it. On your side, it's in the Horneater Peaks.
That's hundreds of miles from here, Adolin said.
There's supposedly another perpendicularity, Azure said. It's unpredictable and dangerous and appears randomly in different places. My guides warned against trying to hunt it.
Guides? Kaladin said. Who were these guides?
Why, spren, of course.
Adolin glanced toward the distant city they'd left, where there had been fear spren and pain spren aplenty.
Not like those, Azure said, laughing. People spren. Like these two.
Which raises a question, Adolin said, pointing as the spren with the strange eyes rejoined them. That's the soul of my shard blade. Syl is Kaladin's and Pattern Shallan's. So, he pointed at the weapon at her belt. Tell us honestly, Azure. Are you a Knight Radiant?
No.
Adolin swallowed.
Say it. You're a herald, then. She laughed.
No. What? A herald? Those are basically gods, right? I'm no figure from mythology, thank you very much. I'm just a woman who has been constantly out of her league since adolescence. Trust me.
Adolin glanced at Kaladin. He didn't seem convinced either.
Really?
Azure said.
There's no spren here for my blade because it's flawed. I can't summon or dismiss it like you can yours. She's a handy weapon, but a pale copy of what you carry.
She patted it.
Anyway, when I last crossed this place, I hired a ship to convey me.
A ship? Kaladin said.
Sailed by whom? Spren. I hired it at one of their cities.
Cities?
Kaladin looked towards Syl.
You have cities? Where do you think we lived?
Syl said, amused.
Lightspren are usually guides, Azure continued. They like to travel, to see new places. They sail all across Roshar's Shadesmar, peddling goods, trading with other Spren. You're supposed to watch out for cryptics.
Pattern hummed happily.
Yes, we are very famous.
What about using soul casting? Adolin looked to Shallan. Could you make us supplies?
I don't think it would work, Shallan replied. When I soul cast, I change an object's soul here in this realm, and it reflects in the other world. If I changed one of these beads, it might become something new in the physical realm, but it would still be a bead to us. Food and water aren't impossible to find here, Azure said, if you can make it to a port city. The Spren don't need these things, but humans living on this side, and there are some, need a constant supply. With that stormlight of yours, we can trade. Maybe buy passage to the Horneater Peaks.
That would take a long time, Kaladin said. Alethkar is falling right now, and the Blackthorn needs us.
He was interrupted by a haunting screech.
It was reminiscent of sheets of steel grinding against one another. It was met by others, echoing in unison.
Adolin spun toward the sounds, shocked by their intensity. Syl put her hands to her lips, and Pattern cocked his strange head.
What was that? Kaladin demanded.
Azure hurriedly began shoving their supplies into Kaladin's pack. You remember before we slept how I said we'd be fine unless we attracted the wrong Spren?
Yes.
We should get moving.
Now.
Illustration: Rosharan Wines. The cultured Vorin knows their wines and speaks confidently on the subject. Types of wine, in order of strength. Weakest, pink. Floral aids alertness.
I've had milk more intoxicating than this.
Orange, fruity, with notes of ginger. Yellow, bold and deep, without guilt. Auburn, spicy taste with an earthy aroma.
Made from fermented fruit, and is similar to the grapevines we're used to.
Red, flavorful with a pleasant burn. Sapphire, nutty taste with hints of honey.
Made from fermented lapis grain. Depending on the infusions, this traditionally tastes more like whiskey.
Strongest, blue, complex notes of berry and lemon. Violet, spiced sandalwood aroma. It serves the cultured Vorin well to be versed in the diverse beers, mud beers, ciders, juices, and lagers of other cultures. Cider is served chilled, if possible. Horn-eater lager should not be drunk in the presence of enemies.
Responsible for that embarrassing tattoo of mine.
Winespren are quite rare, reported only in foreign nations.
What? Rare? I see these all the time.
94. A small bottle. 7 years ago. Dalinar stumbled as he swept everything from the dresser, upending a bowl of hot soup. He didn't want soup. He yanked out drawers, dumping clothing to the ground, steam curling from the spilled broth. They'd done it again. They'd taken his bottles. How dare they? Couldn't they hear the weeping? He roared, then grabbed his trunk, overturning it. A flask rolled out along with the clothing. Finally, something they hadn't found. He slurped down the dregs it contained and groaned. The weeping echoed around him. Children dying, Evie begging for her life. He needed more, but
Wait. Did he need to be presentable? The hunt. Was that today? Stupid man, he thought. The last of the hunts had been weeks ago. He'd convinced Gavilar to come with him out into the wilderness, and the trip had gone well. Dalinar had been presentable, sober, commanding even. A figure right from the Storming Songs. They'd discovered those parshmen. They'd been so interesting. For a time, away from civilization, Dalinar had felt like himself. His old self. He hated that person. Growling, he dug in his large wardrobe. This fort on the eastern rim of Alethkar was the first mark of civilization on their trip home. It had given Dalinar access, again, to the necessities of life. Like wine. He barely heard the rap on his door as he flung coats out of the wardrobe. When he looked over, he saw two youths standing there. His sons. Anger Spren boiled around him. Her hair. Her judgmental eyes. How many lies about him had she stuffed into their heads? What? Dalinar roared. Adolin stood his ground. Almost 17 now, fully a man. The other one, the invalid, cringed down. He looked younger than his, what, 12 years, 13? We heard the commotion, sir, Adolin said, jutting out his chin. We thought you might need help.
I need nothing. Out! Get out!
They scrambled away. Dalinar's heart raced. He slammed the wardrobe and pounded his fists on the bedside table, toppling the sphere lamp. Puffing, groaning, he fell to his knees. Storms. They were only a few days' march from the ruins of Rathalas. Was that why the screaming was louder today? A hand fell on his shoulder.
Father?
Adolin, so help me.
Still kneeling, Dalinar turned, then cut off. It wasn't Adolin, but the other one. Renarin had returned, timid as always, his spectacled eyes wide and his hand trembling. He held something out, a small bottle.
I,
Renarin swallowed.
Got you one, with the spheres the king gave me. Because you always go through what you buy so quickly.
Dalinar stared at that bottle of wine for an endless moment.
Gavilar hides the wine from me, he mumbled. That's why none is left. I couldn't possibly have drunk it all.
Renarin stepped in and hugged him. Dalinar flinched, bracing as if for a punch. The boy clung to him, not letting go.
They talk about you,
Renarin said.
But they're wrong. You just need to rest. After all the fighting you did. I know. And I miss her too.
Dalinar licked his lips.
What did she tell you? He said, voice ragged. What did your mother say about me?
The only honest officer in the army,
Renarin said.
The honorable soldier. Noble. Like the heralds themselves. Our father. The greatest man in Alethkar.
What stupid words. Yet Dalinar found himself weeping. Renarin let go, but Dalinar grabbed him, pulling him close.
Oh, Almighty. Oh, God. Oh, God, please. I've started to hate my sons.
Why hadn't the boys learned to hate him back? They should hate him. He deserved to be hated.
Please, anything. I don't know how to get free of this. Help me. Help me.
Dalinar wept and clung to that youth, that child, as if he were the only real thing left in a world of shadows. 95. Inescapable void. Yelignar had great powers, perhaps the powers of all searchers compounded in one. He could transform any Voidbringer into an extremely dangerous enemy.
Curiously, three legends I found mention swallowing a gemstone to engage this process. From Hesse's Mythica, page 27. Kaladin marched at speed through Shadesmar, trying, with difficulty, to control the simmering dissatisfaction inside of him. "Mm-mm," Pattern said as another screech sounded behind them. "Humans, you must stop your emotions. They are very inconvenient here." The group hiked southward along the narrow line of land that overlaid the river in the real world. Shallan was the slowest of them and had difficulty keeping up. So they'd agreed she should hold a little stormlight. It was either that or let the screeching spren reach them. "What are they like?" Adolin said to Azure, puffing as they marched. "You said those sounds were from anger spren. Boiling pools of blood?"
"That's the part you see in the physical realm," Azure said. "Here, that's merely their saliva pooling as they drool. They're nasty."
"And dangerous," Syl said.
She scampered along the obsidian ground and didn't seem to get tired.
"Even to spren. But how did we draw them? Nobody was angry, right?"
Kaladin tried again to smother his frustration.
"I wasn't feeling anything other than tired," Shallan said.
"I felt overwhelmed," Adolin said. "Still do, but not angry."
"Kaladin?"
Syl said. He looked at the others, then down at his feet.
"It just feels like we're abandoning Kolinar. And only I care. You were talking about how to get food, find a way to the Horneater Peaks, this perpendicularity or whatever. But we're abandoning people to the Voidbringers."
"I care too," Adolin said. "Bridge Boy, that was my home. It—"
"I know,"
Kaladin snapped. He took a breath, forcing himself to calm.
"I know, Adolin. I know it's not rational to try to get back through the Oath Gate. We don't know how to work it from this side, and besides, it's obviously been corrupted. My emotions are irrational. I'll try to contain them. I promise."
They fell silent.
"You're not angry at Adolin," Kaladin thought forcefully. "You're not actually angry at anyone.